question. So again, I'll welcome you all to our topic today, factors affecting the fractional equilibrium levels of radon and its progeny indoors. I'm going to turn things over to our first speaker, Stuart Walker, who's joining us from EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation, where he has been with us at EPA headquarters since 1990. His primary areas of responsibility include serving as a Superfund program's national lead on issues regarding radioactively contaminated surplus sites, and he develops national policy for characterization and cleanup and management of these sites. So Stuart, I'm going to pull up your presentation materials and I will turn the floor to you to begin.
Okay, thank you, Jane. Oh, there we go. So you actually already introduced me, and we already know the name of the webinar today, so let's go to the next slide. I'm going to talk a little bit about, I'm going to provide a little background on why EPA needed this research project on radon progeny equilibrium levels. So a little bit of background on why we started and give a little brief overview of CERCLA, which is the, for the Superfund program for site remediation, our tools for looking at radon intrusion and why this project was needed. Next slide. So we have a whole variety of we call calculators, which are basically online models. So for looking at cancer risk, we have the PRG, which stands for Preliminary Remediation Goals, deals with soil, water, air, soil to water. That first came out in 2002. I think we've had about 22 updates to that. And then on the BPRG is basically for inside buildings. So B standing for buildings. And SPRG, which S stands for surfaces, is dealing with outside hard surfaces. So the BPRG deals with dust and fixed contamination inside a building, and the SPRG deals with fixed contamination such as contaminated street sidewalks, outside walls of buildings, and in dust on roadways. Then we have dose-based calculators, and we have a dose-based standard that we're also, if we're complying with the dose-based standard, for how to figure out the concentrations that correspond to that. So the DCC, that's like dose compliance concentrations calculator, which does the same thing as a PRG, except it does dose instead of risk. That came out in 2004. Then we also have the BDCC for inside buildings and SDCC for outside hard surfaces. So this talk today focuses mostly on the research project to support the RVSL, which is Radon Vapor Intrusion Screening Level Calculator that came out in 2021. And that also looks at cancer risk levels, dose levels, and also the UMTRCA standards in ARR. And UMTRCA stands for Uranium Mill Tailing Radiation Control Act, which is we typically, if we're dealing with indoor radon at a Superfund site, that's what we're usually meeting as an ARR. An ARR stands for applicable or relevant appropriate requirements. So those are applicable or requirements you'd have to meet, whether it's a Superfund site or not. Relevant and appropriate, which is pretty much all the UMTRCA standards are only relevant and appropriate, are those that are sufficiently similar to the situation you're addressing at the Superfund site. You meet them as if they were applicable, basically. So, and then also on the chemical side, we have the RSL, which is Regional Screening Level Calculator for soil, water, and air, which is similar to the PRG and DCC, except it's dealing with chemicals. It also deals with total uranium. You have to address that. And the Vapor Intrusion Screening Level Calculator, which came out in 2018, which is similar to the RVSL, but deals with chemical volatiles. Next slide, please. And this is just a screenshot of the RVSL. If you've been to any of the calculators, they have a similar format. Go to the homepage, and on the right-hand side, you can see the pages that you can click to on that calculator, the homepage. There's always an online user guide. What's new is basically every time the calculator changes, that changes the results. We list that by year and date, frequently asked questions, equations, if you want to go back and look at the equations that are underlying the calculator, then the calculator itself, running the calculator to get the results, some information on running the decay chain for different radionuclides, and generic tables, which we have not had up for a while, but we're now starting to put those back up for the calculators, for at least the radiation calculators. Next slide. So the ARVISL was an internet calculator tool. It's developed to provide concentrations of radon and thorium in soil and groundwater that will not result in radon intrusion to buildings that exceed target levels. So it's focused on radon 222, 220, and we also included 219, even though that doesn't get used much at Superfund. So it has, a risk-based portion, which defaults towards 1 × 10⁻⁶, although with indoor radon, you're typically only looking at risk to tell what the risk is of the error that you're meeting for UMTRCA, which is UMTRCA standards only for radon 222 and 220 and correspond to 0.02 working levels. Then if there is a dose-based standard, it default to one millirem per year. And then we can also run it for intrusion to not exceed 4 picocuries per liter, which is the indoor radon guidelines for EPA for the public, which we don't use as an AROR at Superfund sites, but there are some state standards that have adopted that level, and those can be used as an AROR. Next slide, please. So the conceptual site model for the ARVISL, if you've ever played around with the VISL, it's very similar. Assumes a groundwater beta zone of vapors that diffuse upwards through the unsaturated soils and toward the surface and into the buildings themselves. The soil is supposed to be relatively homogeneous and isotropic, and horizontal layers of different soil types can be used. Next slide. Continuing the conceptual site model, the receptors are occupants in a building that has a concrete foundation. They're either residents or workers. And there are some subsurface and building characteristics that reduce or attenuate the radon concentrations. Next slide. So we're in a site-specific mode. There's not a lot of things to change in the ARVISL compared to some of the other calculators. So you have some of the basic things you can change to be things like the number of years the resident is there, the frequency, so how many days per year they're at the residence or work at their office building, hours per day. Is there any gamma shielding, which there is not generally, so, and then the inhalation rate. But the first thing you see there is a select air exchanges per hour. And so let's go to the next slide and look at that a little bit more closely. So that drop-down menu, you can pick different air exchange rates within the calculator. And once you do that, next slide, please. As you change the air exchange rate, basically the air, as it increases, the inhalation fractional equilibrium, we call FEQ, decreases. So there's less progeny present indoors. This basically decreases the risk, the dose, or the working levels. So the calculator defaults towards an air exchange rate that in the exposure factors handbook says that the U.S. in the U.S. buildings for either resident or occupational, 90% of the buildings would have a higher air exchange rate. So if you can determine that site specifically, they have a higher air exchange rate, then you can alter the, you can pick a more appropriate air exchange rate in the calculator in the drop-down menu. And this slide is just showing the effects as in the Oak Ridge technical manual that explains the analysis that was done to alter the air exchange rates and then the equilibrium levels as you change the air exchange rates. Next slide. And here again, it's a table comparing for radon 220, different air exchange rates. So zero, you know, there's no air being exchanged, which of course would be bad since eventually I would actually kill you. 0.18 is the residential default and 0.6 is the commercial default. So commercial buildings have a higher air exchange rate. And as you can see, the different the blue level, like blue is the radon 222. And as you have a higher air exchange rate, you can see some of the progeny getting smaller as you go through the three different categories. So 0.18 has a reduced level of progeny, and then the 0.6 has an even further reduced level. Okay, let's go to the next slide. And as I mentioned, this is all explained in a 50-page analysis underlying the R vessel. So the air exchange rate's impact on, I'm not going to read that whole thing. But basically, this background document is issued by Oak Ridge National Laboratory in support of the R vessel, helps go through the analysis underlying that little drop-down table and why it's changing the numbers the way it's changing them. Okay, next slide. So we thought, though, working through on the R vessel, that the existing approach may not be enough, and that may still be overestimating the risk doses or working levels. So other factors that could significantly impact the equilibrium levels of radon progeny were exhalation, solid particle concentration, surface deposition, and air quality. So all these equilibrium levels that are affected also affect compliance with the UMPRCA working level standards and ARR, or risk assessment and dose assessment. And next slide.
Stuart, that appears to be the end of it.
Okay, so that's basically then why we started the intern research project. And so I will let you move on, Jane, to Caitlin.
All right, excellent. So Caitlin, I can see that you are coming on camera. So I'm going to go ahead and add your video up here on the screen. And then bear with me. Caitlin, if you want to go ahead and turn on your screen share, I will introduce the audience to you as your materials are coming up on the screen. So we're going to be joined by Caitlin Shanahan, who is a recent graduate of Lewis University with a BS of Biology and a BA in Spanish Language and Culture. She's been finishing her master's in chemistry with a focus on conductive biomaterials for wastewater remediation. During this past year, she's worked as an intern exploring factors that affect the indoor concentrations of radon and its progeny to improve the R vessel calculations under Stuart's guidance, as well as with some other EPA staff who are joining us and other EPA partners through the U.S. Department of State's Virtual Student Federal Service. So she actually has recently joined U.S. EPA Region 5 as a remedial project manager. So Caitlin, I can confirm that your slides are up, so I will turn the floor to you.
All right. Good morning, everybody, or I should say good afternoon. So as Stuart mentioned, we're going to be talking about factors affecting the fractional equilibrium factor of radon and its progeny. We'll also be looking at actinon and thoron as well, but on a much smaller scale. So as Stuart mentioned, and as Jean mentioned as well, this project was supported in part by an appointment to the US EPA, and that was administered by the United States Department of State through the Virtual Student Federal Service. So that's where the internship kind of came from. I do also want to thank Lewis University, my home university, for allowing me this opportunity to pursue this internship while continuing my studies. Additionally, I want to thank my own research group and Oak Ridge National Laboratory, specifically Fred, who you'll see on this next slide. So four very important people to this project. It wouldn't be made possible without them. I want to take some time to thank Stuart, who you just saw, and Fred, both who really were the guiding mentors throughout this project, as well as, you know, editorial advice and just generally really great people to work with. Additionally, I want to thank Michelle Burgess and John Richards for their added value support, who are also US EPA background as well. Okay, so getting into it, Stuart touched a little bit on the R vessel calculator or the radon vapor intrusion screening level calculator, but I wanna kind of dive a little bit deeper into it. And so with radon and its daughter products acting as the second leading cause of lung cancer, it's really imperative to monitor their presence inside both commercial, community, and even residential dwellings. And so the thing that we're going to be really focusing on today is the radon indoor inhalation fractional equilibrium factor. I know that can be a mouthful, so we're just going to be referring to it as an FEQ. And so the FEQ is a unitless disequilibrium ratio of measured radon gas to its progeny alpha emissions at equilibrium in a specified volume. Breaking that down a little bit more, basically you have radon itself, and you have their progeny, which is, your chain of decay, and then you have your progeny. And so it's that disequilibrium ratio between those two things in a specific volume that we're going to be looking at. And so within the past 30 years, a pretty well-rounded understanding of how air exchange rates affect this equilibrium factor has been developed, but this has now also led to the creation of the Arvissel calculator actually exactly 1 year ago today. So we've got a little birthday celebration there for our Arvissel. And so the goal of the calculator is to assist risk assessors, remedial project managers, and such as myself and others involved with risk assessment and decision making at Superfund sites, also known as CERCLA sites. So CERCLA, for those of you who are not familiar with it, is the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act. And so at those sites, the Arvissel helps in developing quite literally Arvissels, radon vapor intrusion screening levels, or as Stuart mentioned, also preliminary remediation goals for indoor radon 222, radon 220, and radon 219. That are risk or dose based. And so it does this by providing screening level concentrations, so SLs, and that is of radon for groundwater, soil gas, which covers both subslab and exterior, as well as indoor air to assist in making an Arvissel determination, which is really based on the preliminary data that you're seeing in site sampling. And so it does this based on a mathematical calculation of hourly air exchange rates, so ACHs, and Stuart kind of went through what those look like and the trends that you can see based on those results. So this is, in reference to that. It also looks at the decay rates of chain members. So as I said, when we have progeny, that's what we'll be referring to as those that are coming off of radon that are being broken down over time. And so the cancer risk and dose from calculated indoor air concentrations can also be user provided. And so that can be calculated just as Stuart had shown too. So you can input your own information if you have a guess of what the sample might be prior to, a sampling event, or you have a situation in which you have preliminary results and you want to input it before having it fully assessed, you can do so. And so in an effort to advance the risk assessment specifically of those radon isotopes, we decided to take a closer look at the impact of factors such as exhalation, solid particle concentration, surface deposition, and air quality. And those we thought were some necessary factors that would be affecting the equilibrium factor. So furthermore, in this review, studies regarding the influence of these factors were summarized over a course of several different papers and organizations, research that they had done. And it's just compiled into not only this presentation, but also a paper that can be found in the resources tab. And really the whole goal of this was to provide a more comprehensive approach to establishing risk assessment in public health. And so here we have table one. Table one is going to be on two slides. It's really saying the same thing. So I'm going to be kind of addressing this first slide in unison with that second one. So as I mentioned, the radon indoor fractional equilibrium factor, so again, that FEQ, it's one of the main determinants of risk as it measures the total alpha energy of radon itself over the alpha emissions of radon progeny at equilibrium in a specific volume again. So I'm just kind of reiterating that there. And you might be wondering what alpha emissions are if you don't have some background on this. And so alpha particles are ionizing, or in this case, gaining or losing charge, and that they do so very quickly. And this is because of their double positive charge, their large mass comparative to a beta particle, and because they are relatively slow moving. And so this can cause multiple ionizations within a very small distance. And if you think about it, think about your lungs when inhaled. This gives them a potential to do much more biological damage for the same amount of deposited energy, especially in the case of inhalation. So, and at equilibrium in an enclosed space with no ventilation whatsoever, the value of FEQ is equal to one. Now, we don't often see this because there's obviously many factors that can affect this. And so conditions such as atmospheric pressure or meteorological changes, building and other natural materials, air exchanges and air quality as well, and particle deposition on surfaces or on aerosol particles are all things that can affect that number. So you very rarely would ever see one. But it is important to mention that that's kind of what we base our studies off of here. And so another key assessment value listed in table one is the working level. And so those working levels are going to be those first, second and third columns there. You'll see PCI per liters and BQ per meter cubed. So for my fellow Americans here, it's picocuries per liter is one of the ways that it's represented. And for a more international audience, it's more commonly represented as becquerels per meter cubed. And so what that really means, a working level, according to the US EPA's Code of Federal Regulations, a working level is defined as a combination of short-lived radon decay products per liter of air. And that results from a total emission of alpha particles with energy equaling that of 130 billion electron volts. And I know that's quite the definition, but you can think of it as you have a really large source of energy and you are talking about that short-lived radon decay products per, again, a specified volume. And so in an effort to mitigate both long and short-term exposures in dwellings and other public settings, risk assessments for public health have been conducted to determine the indoor radon fractional equilibrium factor, again, that FEQ. Inappropriate working levels of radon and its progeny have been established too through not only EPA and NIST, but other governing bodies as well. And so presently, the RVSL calculator accounts for these working level conversions to indoor air concentrations, as we can see here. And again, so we have both units, for easy viewing purposes. So moving on to this next slide, again, it's the same table here. So covering the same information, I just want to also make mention of Oak Ridge National Laboratory, which Stuart brought up a good point. We have most of our research was based on a study done by Oak Ridge National Laboratory, put into a technical memo. And so they're kind of the gold standard for looking at radon, thorium, and actinon in the US here. So, and one more important thing to point out here before we move on is you can see the FEQ for radon 222, more specifically known as radon, is 0.4. That's kind of the suggested limit that's pretty common amongst those governing bodies. And so that's going to be a value that we're going to compare a lot of our other FEQs to, and we'll see both an increase and a decrease in some of things that affect those numbers. So now more specifically, what's affecting that FEQ? What's affecting those working levels? And so here we have factors that increase it. When we increase the fractional equilibrium factor, we are essentially increasing our risk. So numbers that are higher are not necessarily better in this case, that means you have a higher risk. And so I will be breaking down these more specifically in the next few slides, but you know, a compiled list of these factors can obviously be seen here. The one I want to first draw attention to will be smoking. Okay, and so smoking is really one of, you know, not only one of the greatest contributing factors to health risks in general, but it's really one of the biggest contributors to radon 222 and radon 220. So both radon and thoron, and their prevalence indoors. So we looked at a study by the World Health Organization that concluded that smokers and ex-smokers, so people who have smoked at least 15 cigarettes per day, not necessarily less, could have been more. And those are people who have done that for a certain amount of time over their lifetime. So according to WHO, the World Health Organization, these people have a substantially higher risk of developing radon-induced lung cancer than people who have never smoked or have only experienced secondhand smoke on rare occasions. And so the risk of radon 220 and 222 concentrations associated with this lifetime of smoking, again, can be classified as smoking 15 or more cigarettes per day. And that's an increased risk of 16%, which doesn't sound as much as, you know, some other things, certainly. But when you think about not only the damage that it does to your lungs, just from the other contaminants that are present in smoking. But once you take into account the 16% increase from radon alone, it starts to become very worrying. And so basically what this means is that the concentration of radon 222 that it takes for this increase in this excess lifetime cancer risk is far lower, you know, with the fewer cigarettes that you smoke. So, or the more cigarettes that you smoke, excuse me. So we have a much lower need for increasing it as we see for chronic smokers. And it's going to be a much larger number of cigarettes that would need to be smoked in order for that same risk to be essentially achieved by a non-smoker. So again, really, this is evident that for lifelong non-smokers, the comparative risk concentration is reduced 10 times, so a full 10 times lower compared to that of a chronic smoker. And so for each cigarette smoked daily or from which smoke is inhaled secondhand, there's a 0.01 picocurie per liter, or again, for my international friends here, 0.37 becquerels per meter cubed. And that's an increase for up to 15 cigarettes per day, because at that point, we do want to say that anything more is accounted for in values of chronic smoking. So overall, the lesson here would really just be smoking, not a good thing for your health, not a good thing for the health of your loved ones or coworkers, things like that. And so ultimately, the RVISL calculator results may greatly underestimate the excess lifetime cancer risk for smokers, and especially those who live in higher risk regions of the world as well. So this next factor we're going to be taking a look at, there's actually more than one here, but generally speaking, this leads to one of the other greatest factors of increased radon 222 concentrations indoors, and that is biogeochemical factors. And looking at these helps us to determine what type of landscapes and environments contribute more greatly to those elevated concentrations and equilibrium factors. And so environmental factors such as precipitation, elevation and pressure, as well as exhalation, all contribute to radon vapor intrusion. And so you'll see rain on the screen here, and it's in reference to our specific rain and humidity issue. And so rain disrupts the natural ordering of soil and can lead to corrosion of bedrock, which then releases radon that was once trapped as an inert gaseous in its inert gaseous form. And so the reason this is an issue is because once you have a disturbance, This increases the concentration of free radon from emanation, which then begins its chain of decay. And it's through that chain of decay that risk begins to increase, because those daughter products, again, are alpha emitting, and that's just being inhaled in that indoor setting. So again, furthermore, increasing your excess lifetime cancer risk. And so this is evidenced by the increasing FEQ of, as you can see in the table, 0.69 plus or minus 0.18 for your FEQ. So you're talking about quite a big jump there. And so that's also in reference, again, to the US EPA and NIST values of 0.4. The other thing I would like to call to attention with rain is that it can be particularly acidic. On average, it has a pH of 5.6, but can often be found lately as an effect of climate change to be even lower. And this over time can erode rock, and those rock bodies can obviously emit radon even faster once they begin to degrade. And so in one study that we mentioned in our paper, the overall average of a full day of rain was 6.9 picocuries per liter, or again, 255.3 becquerels per meter cubed, which might not mean anything until you think about the suggested limit of 4 picocuries per liter being the limit. So that's quite a big jump again. And so the other factor here is high altitude. And at high altitudes, there's obviously less barometric pressure, which means that the air is thinner. And in dwellings at high altitudes, so what we're considering a high altitude is about 2,500 meters or around 8,000 feet, this can mean that the thinner air results in less plating out onto air particles and ultimately less deposition onto a surface. So you're having those free-floating particles, you know, just you're breathing those free-floating particles in, which obviously increases your risk of radon-related cancers from those alpha emissions of the progeny that we have mentioned earlier. And so here we look at lack of air exchange. Now, again, as Stuart mentioned in that first presentation, air exchange is kind of the thing that really primarily drives radon vapor intrusion calculations. And so just like free-floating particles that have not been deposited onto a surface and how those are an issue, so is a lack of airflow or air exchange. And air exchange is really dependent on elevated levels of ventilation for enclosed spaces. And so prior to the 1980s, the average ventilation rate for a dwelling was much higher, which really means faster complete air exchange. So, you know, you have fresh stuff constantly replenishing itself. And that was in both residential and commercial spaces, which were previously defined as leaky. And that was just due to their macroporous gaps that could be found in foundations or other building materials that were often used, such as wood, which obviously have more gapping and more greater porosity. And that allowed greater airflow. And so more recently, you can see that building standards have tightened. And there's now also a greater prevalence of HVAC systems. So originally it was thought, okay, well, an HVAC system or a mechanical ventilation system will help to kind of promote that air exchange. But we've really seen that that's not been the case. And so mechanical ventilation has actually been suggested to maintain or improve air exchange rates, but the use of central cooling and heating really contributes to an increased equilibrium factor. And so during emanation, radon flows through a pressure gradient. And so if you want to think about this, when coupled with warmer and thinner air of a dwelling, this results in a greater concentration of progeny flowing indoors where their pressure is lower. And you can think about it like a lock for, you know, our folks on lakes and things like that, oceans. When you open the gate, you know, to a less filled compartment, the water floods in and then you reach equilibrium. Well, the same thing can be occur with radon 222 or radon 220, also actinon, radon 219. And it can do the same thing. So when you're at a higher concentration, it's flowing lower to equilibrate. And furthermore, this highlights how flow rate and air exchange rates really affect that equilibrium factor. But another thing to consider is how we move, how people like me and you move on our day-to-day lives. And so when people are moving in and out of a space, using spaces more often, especially in mild weather where there's minimal HVAC use, there's really a positive effect. It reduces risk. And so ideally during these hours of peak movement, when kids are at school, people are at work, businesses and commonplace dwellings are bustling. Your typical hours of 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. are inactive, and our hours of activity would be, 6 a.m. to about 4 p.m. Those are, generally speaking, the hours that we're out and about most, right? And so that lowers your FEQ. You're going to have a lower FEQ than 0.4, which is that suggested limit. But on the other hand, you're going to be increasing that FEQ when you are less active. And so this whole idea is because with the greater flux of people in and out of a dwelling, during those periods of work or school, recreation, things like that, air exchange just generally improves just because you have open doors and windows, things are constantly shutting and opening. You also have a greater area and places for deposition to occur. More furnishings are in, commonly used places. You're going to see, benches in malls and things like that. Those are all surfaces that particle deposition can occur. So again, you're taking that radon and its progeny and plating it out onto a surface rather than having it free floating and causing greater risk to your lungs. When the day is done, though, and people return to their homes, during the evening and early morning hours, there's less, of that in and out style of movement. And that FEQ then increases all the way to 0.87. That's a roughly 47% increase from the suggested limit of that 0.4. And so it should be noted that the effects of activity and inactivity are not that well studied for thoron and actinon, but generally we can assume that the trends hold similar as they're not depositing out and there's greater air exchange. And so now, kind of taking a little bit of a switch here, we're going to talk about population and smog and the impact of those. And so in densely populated areas like urban sites, primarily industrial regions, the prevalence of smog in conditions like thermal inversions, and if you don't know what a thermal inversion is, it's basically that opposite effect that you would typically see in a day on your weather. And so in those settings, it can result in a decrease in atmospheric air exchanges, which causes progeny to plate out onto gaseous particles without clean air dilution. So you're not cleaning it up. It's just continually being, dirty and you're breathing that type of air in. And that enters your indoor setting just the same as it would exist outdoors. And so it's really important to note that when we deem, air is clean, it isn't that there's not, gas or particulate matter present. It's just that those concentration levels of things like, carbon monoxide, nitrogen dioxide, or ozone are not harmful. The same really can't be said about areas with heavy smog, because in these environments, air quality is really decreased. And that's just due to the recycling, the constant reuse of that gaseous particle-rich air. And that causes those concentrations in the overall FEQ to surpass those suggested limits of 0.4. When you have dirty air, if you're breathing it in, you're exhaling it out, or it's depositing into your lungs and causing bigger issues there as well. And so while those air pollutants pose their own issues, radon, thoron, and actinon all, you know, further plate out onto these particles. And this increases your overall excess lifetime cancer risk again. So, and that's just due to heightened bronchial dosage from alpha decay emissions, as well as other pollutants that are just depositing again onto your lungs. Typically we look at a qualifying factor known as air quality index. So for my air and radiation folks, you guys, this might be right up in your wheelhouse here. Air quality index can alert us if the air for the day, is safe or safe enough to breathe outside with no issues, or things like if people with allergies or asthma or other, lung issues should really steer clear of being outside, things like that. And so it's a useful tool, and it really can be used in addition to help determine if radon-222, so radon, regular radon concentrations, will be more or less prevalent in not only outside, but in a dwelling. So for our study, we decided to look at one study that was done in Sydney, New South Wales, Australia. And smog there had an air quality index greater than 30, which then increased the deposition of radon-222 between 6.6 parts per billion and as much as 12.4 parts per billion. So kind of a wide range there. But both of those increase your excess lifetime cancer risk quite a lot. And so overall, to draw attention back to FEQ here, this equates to an overall increase in FEQ between 0.48 and 0.79. And that really just depends on the magnitude of pollution, that's present within that smog area. Other things that can affect that also are, altitude, seasonal, temperature-wise, humidity, things like that, and air exchanges again. And so a little bit of a switch up here as well. So kind of back to those biogeochemical factors where we talked a little bit about emanation rate, we're going to see that here with mining and fracking as well. It's well known that there's an increased risk of lung cancer, just lung cancer incidents really associated with mining. And that can also come from greater exposure to radon progeny. So not just your typical, black lung as people call it, but also other issues that can present themselves later on. Many studies have shown that there's a direct relation to radon-222 and radon-220 alpha emissions. And that's as the exposure of increased emanation rate is present. And what that really means. Essentially, an increased emanation rate results from disruption of those rock bodies. So, when you're drilling or hammering away at a rock body, you're obviously causing cracks and gaps to form. And it's through those cracks and gaps and things like that, which radon, which was once presently inert, and in its gaseous state, is then released into the air. And that chain of decay begins immediately. And once that chain of decay starts, you begin to see the effects of those radon progeny and the emissions that they're giving off, the off-gassing, if you will. So we looked at a study that focused specifically on mining certain metal ores, such as uranium. And we looked at how that increases bronchial dosage by up to 15%, which can be attributed to not only emanation rate, but also a lack of ventilation in those enclosed spaces. You have to think, how deep down are you in a mine when you're, chipping away, trying to get uranium ore out? It's quite deep. You don't have a lot of fresh air. So you're kind of really at a true max emanation rate in with little air exchange. And so similar to mining is hydraulic fracturing or fracking as most people know it. And that's for oil or other deeply buried resources. And that can also increase the concentration of radon far past the suggested limits. And so we looked at a study from Pennsylvania. And during a period of growth in the hydraulic fracking industry, earlier in the 2000s, there were 7,469 unconventional wells drilled. And that was just over the course of 1 year. And so buildings within 20 kilometers of a well site had an average radon concentration of 8.4 picocuries per liter. Again, reminding you here, the average concentration is around four. So 8.4 picocuries per liter, or 310 becquerels per meter cubed. That's 42% greater than the suggested limits by US EPA. So if you're in that close range of a fracking well site, you're going to be more greatly exposed and more likely to increase your excess lifetime cancer risk there. There are other underground working spaces as well. It's not just mines and hydraulic fracturing areas, but there's also things like caves and tourist mines and even thermal spas. And these environments can have a very wide range of concentrations of radon and its progeny. So it has a kind of variable FEQ as well. And so there's different limits that are suggested for these areas based on different governing bodies, whether it be European Union or, you know, US, it varies from place to place. And so if you want to learn more about that, I would really encourage you to look at our paper, which is under the resources tab again in that webinar homepage there. So we talked a lot about things that increase your risk. And obviously we want to draw attention to that so that people are aware of things that could potentially be harmful for them, their families, their coworkers, their environment that they're in daily. But there are things that decrease it again. And so I do just want to quickly draw attention to some things that I did mention here. You know, when we have more movement in spaces, when we're, you know, more active throughout the day, you know, 6 a.m. to 4 p.m. again, you're seeing a much lower equilibrium factor than you would in the evening when, you know, there are less people present, less in and out movements. You know, again, altitude, conversely to what we saw at high altitude, at sea level, you have, you know, a little bit thicker air, if you will. And that allows for more particle deposition. Again, those thermal spas, tourist mines, show caves, those also all can lower your FEQ just based on, again, number of people in and out, the airflow that's constantly being brought in. I had mentioned loose construction, you know, your wood, your lack of insulation, things like that. Those also can contribute. So trying to modify your construction. Now, I'm not saying obviously don't build your concrete and your brick and things in your houses, but there are suggestions of, you know, things like insulation that are, you know, radon preventative and work to mitigate, you know, your concentration indoors. And overall, one of the most important things is that aerosol played out in deposition. That deals with people, that deals with, you know, a couch in your house or a chair at your desk at work, and to everything from humidity. When you have, you know, snow particles out on the ground, you're acting as a passivating layer and keeping that down. You're not letting things out. So deposition is really key to mitigating your risk there. And so in conclusion, I put together this bar graph, and so you can kind of see all of the factors in order of what's giving you, you know, increasing your risk the most, increasing that equilibrium factor the most. And so some values for you here, so you can kind of identify what those bars are. For smoking causes an 80% increase in your FEQ from that 0.4. Again, these are all in reference to the US EPA value of 0.4, the suggested limit for fractional equilibrium indoor inhalation factor for radon. High altitude is about 77.5% increase. Your humidity and rain is about 72.5%. Smog 57.5. So again, obviously you can see the decrease as we're going along here. Tighter construction around 50%. Inactivity. Again, those hours where you're not out and about. 47.5% increase. Just passive, just being passive, not even knowing that that's going on, but you have an increased risk in those hours. Areas of high population. So high population, meaning greater than 3,000 people per kilometer, kilometer cubed. And then, increased emanation rates again, and your mining and your things such as, acidic rain and whatnot that's disrupting those rock bodies, you're seeing a 40% increase. And then underground workspaces again is 35. So getting a little bit better as you go, but I specifically want to draw attention to that smoking, high altitude humidity and rain that we're going to be talking about here in the conclusion. And so now that we have some values, while the US EPA's RVISL calculator already applies a mathematical model to predict the theoretical maximum indoor FEQ values, which is, based on air exchange rates, there are obviously additional factors that can significantly impact the airborne concentration of radon and its progeny. And so general results of this project in the literature review that's occurred show that air exchange is the greatest factor impacting the indoor radon FEQ, but there's other factors that can contribute enough to bear consideration. And so based on the studies included, analyzing those factors that increase radon 222, radon 220, and radon 220 or 219, those can identify problem areas not previously addressed by the RVISL calculator. And so you might say, what's next? I know we did. So some three big things that we really want to take a look at and or do. I'm actually going to move right to left here, so a little bit counterintuitive. But the main importance of this study was that we want to be able to provide updates to that RVISL calculator. And so currently, US EPA's RVISL calculator utilizes models that don't address the comparative effects of smoking, especially versus non-smoking. So, that comparison is going to be important to risk assessment. And so according to US EPA's radiogenic cancer risk models and projections for US EPA, US population from 2011, these results showed impacts of smoking, both chronic and periodic usage, are really largely impacting the bronchial dose and your overall cancer risk. And that's based on just high concentrations of radon 222 present indoors in that fractional equilibrium factor that's much higher than we want it to be. And so a modification to the RVISL calculator to improve the safety of the current users, and not even just the current users, but also the general public, those are things that really should be considered. So additionally, we want to utilize air quality index data from representative samples of cities. So ones that have, really high smog content, those that are at high altitudes, things like that, that are constantly affected by changing weather and general air quality. That data can also be used to improve the calculator in relation to smog. And so once again, the RVISL calculator can be further modified, once a greater understanding of these impact factors really has been established. But it's not just the impact factors. We do also want to expand the research into thorium and actinon. I talked a lot about radon 222 today, but there are other, silent killers, as we can call them, with actinon and thorium. And so really analyzing all of those factors in regards to those other two contaminants would be ideally where we would want our research to go next. The other pressing issue too, as we talked about, a lot of it is biogeochemical related, and that can obviously be affected by season. So, taking a potentially twice a year sampling, having a twice a year sampling event for radon 222 indoors, can really make a difference in determining if you're going to have greater risk in the summer or winter or both, and how those compare for your risk and for the risk of public dwellings as well. So, Jean, I think this is where you jump into. We have a few questions that are, you know, kind of predetermined. We just want to hear from you if you might have any other thoughts on these or other resources that we might not know of. So feel free to go ahead and answer those poll questions. We'll open it up to questions after that as well.
Exactly. So the very first question that we've got up on the screen asking if you are aware of a study that assessed equilibrium levels that were not included in this presentation, y'all should see a pop-up poll window asking that. It's a multiple choice style question. So click the circle to the left of the answer. Remember, we're not grading this. We are just trying to collect information and then hit the submit button. I'll leave that open. And as I'm starting to see some results come in, it does look like, Caitlin, there are a handful of people that are aware of some publicly available studies and some that are out there, but they're not necessarily publicly available. So there might be some additional resources. For those of you who are aware of some of these publicly available studies, if you could use the Q&A box and send in additional details about those studies as listed in question two. So you're going to open up the Q&A. If you happen to select, yes, it is publicly available in that pop-up, go ahead and share information on the name of the agency or organization that has gotten that study underway and how we might be able to access information if it's a website, contact, any details you might have. Again, you can send that into the Q&A and I'll be collecting those responses and sharing it with our speakers afterwards. And then, of course, that third question is an open-ended question. You'll also use the Q&A to respond to that one if you are aware of any ongoing research regarding radon, boron, and actinon risk. Pardon me, I've got a screen block here. Sorry about this. So again, you can use the Q&A to privately send in if you have any other examples of ongoing research on these areas and risk assessment. While I'm waiting for some of those responses coming in, there are some links coming in and some specific studies like the ICRP 137. That is one study that multiple attendees are commenting on. So it does look like Caitlin and the team will have some additional references to share with you. So I want to thank everybody. You can continue to send those responses into the Q&A as we begin to transition over to the Q&A period. But I'm going to close that first multiple choice poll. And again, just confirm, Caitlin, it does look like a handful of the audience have some publicly available studies, and we're starting to see some of those responses come into the Q&A. So I appreciate that. I'm going to go ahead and close this out, and we'll move on to the next element. So I see some of our co-speakers are coming on camera. Let me go ahead and add them to the spotlight so that we can see them as I'm reading through questions. And what we'll do now is launch our next segment of our session today, where we have an open Q&A period. For those of you who may not have done it yet, you can click the Q&A button to type up your questions and comments or share references or resources with our speakers. I will read them out loud on your behalf. And then for anybody who has their hand raised, I'll ask if you can go ahead and lower it for now. If we have time, I may be able to take some verbal questions, but it's much faster if you type it into the Q&A. So I'm going to go ahead and lower any hands that might be up and then just ask you to use the Q&A to type up your questions. If you have them, if we have time, I'll let you guys raise your hands and we'll take some verbally. So the very first question, and this is just a small one. Caitlin, you were using the phrase radon vapor in the presentation, and one of the attendees wanted to know, why are you talking about radon vapor as opposed to radon gas?
Yeah, so typically when we're talking about radon gas, it's really in reference to the inert gaseous state before it's already started to go through that chain of decay. So radon vapor is really referring to not only just radon, but also its progeny.
All right, excellent. We had another attendee ask if vaping results in an increase similar to what you noted for smoking.
I am not sure. That would actually be a really interesting study, I would imagine, because of the you know, not only just the nicotine in that, but also the other metals that are in there. I'm sure it would probably contribute, but I don't believe any studies have been done thus far. But if you know of one, let us know.
Okay. And Fred, did you have something you wanted to add?
Yeah, I think that vaping lacks the particulate matter that a burning cigarette does. So it's probably not as great a contributor.
Okay. All right. Carrying on here with some additional questions that came in. What about atmospheric and ambient particles? Would you say that the size of atmospheric or ambient particles impact the frequency?
I'll give it my best shot here, but I would probably defer to Fred as well. I would say yes, just because you can obviously have a 1-to-1 particle ratio. So if you're having smaller particulate matter in the air, but a greater concentration of it, then you're going to have greater radon deposition. So you're going to have less free floating particles that are going to be inhaled. As long as it deposits onto a surface eventually, but if it's still, you know, a particulate matter up in the air, radon attaches to it, and you're breathing that in, it's a double whammy there.
Okay. All right. Excellent. We had one attendee who wanted to know if you can explain how rain increases risk, but snow decreases risk.
Yeah, so interestingly enough, there were some conflicting studies, but after quite some review, it actually kind of, you know, came into the clear. So rain typically disrupts the soil or, you know, the groundwater, things like that, but especially just bedrock in general. And as we talked about, between the acidity of rain and just the general impact of it, you are, disrupting that rock. So you're having an increased emanation rate. You're having radon, off-gassing a little bit more than you otherwise would. And snow kind of just lightly packs it. So it's not able to, radon is not strong enough to kind of break that seal, if you will. And so it just kind of sits on top of it, protecting it from further emanation.
Okay. And we had some follow-on comments that have come in from attendees on just some of the questions I just asked. So one of the attendees noted that perhaps the distribution of particle size is one of the most important parameters that can affect the frequency. And it's also very important to calculate the dose, in other words, the risk. So just a few people chiming in with their thoughts. Also, we did have one attendee who shared a link to a study, and it was a particulate study specifically related to vaping. So that's another resource that I'll collect and share with our organizers today. So I want to thank everyone for chiming in with those. We did have a question that came in: at what altitude does frequency begin increasing? They then ask, does it increase linearly or otherwise?
Fred. So that okay. Go ahead. Apologies.
Did you give me the floor?
Yes, sorry.
Okay, just to go back to the particle size, the equilibrium factors that we calculated were totally non-dependent on particle size. It was as if it was just gas phase. So we are aware that there are certain sizes that are more respirable than others, particularly the PM10. And that's a good point to bring up, and I thank the commenter. So as we move forward with smoking and air quality, the particulate size will be a factor as to whether or not it does present an impact to the lung.
Okay. So Caitlin, I think I'll go back to you with the question about altitude and the frequency increasing.
Yeah, so the altitude that was referenced in the paper was, I think it was about 8,000 or 2,500 meters, so about 8,000 feet, if I'm not mistaken. And it wasn't clear if it was linearly or exponentially, but I do believe it was probably linearly speaking.
Okay. Okay. We did have a follow-on question. If you could elaborate on the influence of humidity, they say increased moisture content on the radon frequency for indoor air. Are you saying that the water droplets will get deposited inside the home where the vapors can emanate? Was this referencing vapors flowing into the building's interior when you were opening and closing doors and windows?
Yeah, so when it comes to humidity, it's just generally talking about environmental factors. So not necessarily that the water droplets are entering your home, so to speak, but that your overall humidity is just increasing it again because you're having a greater emanation rate as it kind of erodes that rock bodies away again. And the other thing too is that it's a lot about pressure. So humidity, when you have higher humidity, you're going to have a little bit, thicker air, so to speak. So you're having particulate matter attracted to that radon. So it's deposition there. Fred or Stuart, would you like to elaborate on that?
I'm seeing thumbs up and nods, so I think they agree. All right, excellent. Moving over here, let's see. Moving on to the next question. You noted in an early slide the ORNL frequency values are showing four figures, and everyone else is showing one. And they wanted to know if the additional ORNL figures are significant. And I think they mean digits, perhaps.
Significant figures, I'm assuming. Yeah. Fred, yes. take the floor on that one since it's your own study there.
That's because here at Oak Ridge National Laboratory, we have very precise measurement equipment that exceeds and surpasses all others. But to be truthful, that is just what we put into our models as the three significant figures. And if you wanted to, you could certainly round it. So those were mathematically derived, and that's just how we present them. So, right. So oftentimes if we present a value that's very rounded and someone tries to check our math, they can't do it. So we offer three significant digits, and we do this for a lot of other screening levels that we produce as well.
All right, excellent. And I do apologize. I've been looking at the abbreviation FEQ and saying frequency when I should have been saying fractional equilibrium. So my apologies. There are many abbreviations and I was doing the wrong one here. So my apologies. Thank you to the audience clarifying that we're talking about fractional equilibrium. So on that note, one of the attendees wanted to know if you can describe the fractional equilibrium measurement methodologies. They wanted to know, do they actually measure alpha energy? As this is in the fractional equilibrium definition.
Right. So in this, I would actually say the best resource that you can find to kind of have this explained would be the user guide for the RVSL calculator, as well as, the paper that was referenced in Stuart's presentation, in addition to our own. So that's what I would say for finding that information out.
Okay. All right. We do have a couple of attendees who have commented that this is causing them to rethink their own exposure. Perhaps maybe they're not going to sit too close to campfires anymore. So just wanted to share those the feedback that we're getting here. Getting back to the questions, one attendee noted, it sounds as if modifications will be including what I describe as, quote, background risk that isn't specifically associated with the site into the RVSL calculator. Is this approach going to be adopted for other RSL, PRG, dose calculators also?
Stuart, you're probably the best one there.
Yeah, and Fred may want to pipe up also, but where we're trying to do is adjust the calculator for how these other effects that aren't really site related, as your person called them, background, how they would impact the equilibrium level. So to the extent that, I'm not sure this would actually correlate over to any normal background like we do in the PRG, because we're looking at what's background off-site in a similar area, as opposed to how is background, you know, we'd normally would be measuring, you know, background, say in soil, as opposed to here where we're trying to do a model and adjust the model to on how the effects of, say, smog or altitude affect the equilibrium level. So it's not a simple, straight measurement as far as the modeling we're doing. So most of the time when we're doing background levels, we're doing samples of background. So this would be where we're modeling the, what we think the equilibrium levels are going to be from the radon, either when it's in the soil or the groundwater, or when it's in the house. And then, so it's more of a modeling exercise. We wouldn't be modeling what background levels are for the other calculators, I don't think. So unless Fred, you can think of an example, but I can't think of where this kind of correlates with something else we're doing.
Well, you can be glad I was muted because it was very loud outside my office and I missed half of the question. And Stuart, what you said did not correlate at all with what portion of the question I heard. So, Gene, if you can, you repeat it?
Sure. Bear with me. I'm going to scroll over here and get back to this most recent question that we read here. Bear with me. Sometimes these things come in and out of order. It was getting into the background of background risk. So they wanted to know if the same methodology that it looks like you're using here in adjusting what would be called background risk is also going to be applied for other calculators. So it sounds as if the modifications will be including what I describe as, quote, background risk that isn't specifically associated with the site into the RVSL calculator. They wanted to know if this approach is going to be adopted for other RSL, PRG, or dose calculators as well.
So I would say no. For these calculators that we do, we calculate the excess lifetime cancer risk that would be in addition to, you know, background and everything. But I think this is a good time to point out that in the calculator, as Caitlin said, an FEQ in an enclosed room without any air exchange would be one. So when we turn the fan on in our mathematical models in a residential situation, it lowers the FEQ to about 0.8. And then we would like to quantify Caitlin's research so we can say, hey, how many cigarettes do you smoke per day? They enter the number and then that would raise the FEQ back up. Or if we say how many days per year is your yard snow covered, that brings the FEQ down. So we want, and we can even ask what altitude do you live at? And then we go to a table and adjust the FEQ accordingly. And what is the air quality index? And we can adjust that FEQ to come up with a more realistic number that represents that scenario. So we're aware that 0.4 is what is measured in most places, while our empirical model came up with 0.8 something. So we know there's a discrepancy and we're on the protective side. So we're trying to apply some real world research that Caitlin went through to adjust our FEQ to situations that people encounter.
Yeah, I was going to say one thing on top of that. Where I would see this affecting other calculators is where we are also addressing indoor radon as part of that. So in the PRG calculator, we actually, for tap water, we actually have the air exchange rate built in now for indoor radon when it's coming out of your tap water. So, but the rest of it, you know, most of the portions of the other calculators, such as like radium and soil for outdoors, are not going to be affected by this kind of research. But to the extent we change it, we incorporate more of the indoor radon into other portions of other calculators, then we would also try to have some of these similar adjustments.
Okay. We did have a few attendees asking about radon levels and fracking. So there were some individuals who were just curious if mining and fracking can affect the concentration of radon in the area. And they wondered if that increase in radon is limited, if that does happen, to a very close range or space around that mining or fracking site, or could it extend beyond? But we've also had a few other attendees note that they don't actually think that there's a correlation between fracking and radon levels. And they were wondering if radon levels had been measured in certain areas like Pennsylvania before fracking became as prevalent.
Yeah, so I'll touch on that first part. The differences in fracking and mining, you know, for a close proximity versus a big range are not well studied. Quite honestly, there's not even that many studies out on the fracking, but Pennsylvania seems to be kind of one of the foremost runners in that, just because of the number of wells that are there. The studies that we referenced were maximum 20 kilometers away from the unconventional well site. Beyond that, I'm not quite sure. I would assume that just based on you know, the further you are away from a contaminant, obviously you're going to have less risk. I would assume that would still hold true in this case. However, I can't really speak on it because I don't know of any research at this point that covers further, you know, regional risk, so to say. And then for that second question there, yes, in fact, there was a difference. I don't know the values off the top of my head, but it is referenced in our paper. And I can always, if you want to reach out via email or whatever means, I can always send you the particular paper that we looked at for both pre and post, I guess, fracking boom, if you want to call it.
Okay. All right. Excellent. We did have a question that came in on your goal. So someone asked, what is the goal here? To allow 30% more exposure to radon when there are people who smoke or there is air pollution present?
Yeah, I'm going to have to defer here. I'm not quite sure I understand the question.
So, I mean, I think the question might be the goal of the project, which I think we were getting into answering that two questions ago, which is to have in adjustments in the calculator in the future that take into account some of these other factors other than air exchange rates that we have already quantified in the calculator. So as Fred was giving the example of putting in the, you know, the elevation of the site, or the number of cigarettes being smoked by the residents or in a particular house. So it's waste. It's looking at waste, doing the research to support another technical manual down the road that would allow us to make more adjustments already built into the calculator.
Okay.
I think that answers that.
Okay. And then we had a few other questions that have come in, and other people who are involved in studies that might be of interest. So I'll share that with you all later. Someone wanted to know, does smoking increase the EF between radon and progeny, or the risk of radon?
EF. I'm not sure. I'm guessing maybe that was just a typo and just overall FEQ.
Yeah, I think that's probably what they meant.
Okay. In that case, when we're talking about FEQ, again, we're talking about that disequilibrium factor or disequilibrium ratio between the radon and its progeny and the emissions that it's giving off. So in regards to that question, I think it would kind of be, you can't really answer it because both are contributing to your FEQ overall.
Okay. We do have some other questions that are coming in looking for some, oh, Fred, you had a follow-on comment?
Yeah, I'll add a little bit to that. So when there's smoke particles lingering in the air, the radon attaches to them and the progeny. and you're far more likely to breathe those progeny into your lungs than if there were no smoke particles in the air. So what happens in a clean room with nothing in the air, as the air current moves past, it creates static electricity on the walls and it pulls the particles and they stick to the walls. But now you've introduced cigarette smoke and the particles are going to stick to the cigarette smoke and be in the air available to be breathed much longer. And that's why there's an increased risk to radon-induced cancer for smokers.
Okay. We have a couple of questions and comments that are coming in asking for input on some site-specific situations and risk factors that you might use or reasonable equilibrium fractions to use for calculating exposures at different site scenarios. And I'm just going to ask Stuart and Fred, in those cases, we might advocate that they reach out to you all directly to sort of talk through site-specific scenarios and how you might be looking at risk. Would that be the best approach?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Excellent. And then just one other comment before we go ahead and get ready to wrap things up today. We did have an attendee who noted that, quote, in a tighter construction home, it is useful to operate several HEPA quality recirculating air filters in primary living areas and bedrooms to reduce the radon progeny levels. And I apologize, that was a question. They wanted to know, is it useful to do that? They note that it's a low cost option compared to installing a radon extraction system under the home. So again, is it useful to operate several HEPA quality recirculating air filters to try to reduce the radon progeny levels?
I would say yes, because you're, having that greater air exchange. So your air exchange rates per hour are going to be, greater. And so therefore you're going to have a lower concentration present.
Okay.
Yeah. I was going to say too, our indoor radon, EPA's indoor radon program does have a website for homeowners and talks about some of the techniques they think they can use to get their levels down too.
Okay.
So I'm not familiar with it. I don't know what some of the recommendations are on that, but I would also urge somebody to look at that site too.
Okay. All right. Well, I think we're getting here to the end of our scheduled time. So I wanted to offer Caitlin any final quick reminders, or Stuart, any reminders on follow-up contact before I offer our closing instructions?
If you have any more information or studies, please provide them. Thank you.
All right. Excellent. Well, with that, I will go ahead and thank Caitlin and Fred and Stuart for their time. And I'm going to go ahead and walk through a series of final closeout reminders before we end our webinar today. So the first thing that I wanted to do is just sort of remind everybody that we are glad to have you all here and hope that you will join us on a future Clue-In Internet seminar. If you haven't, I encourage you to visit us at the Cleanup Information Network at cluein.org and to sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, which I send out on the first of each month, and it highlights free online internet seminar sessions like today. So I encourage you to sign up and subscribe to find out about new online sessions as soon as they are available. And I do want to just remind everybody, if you sent in a study, a recommendation, a question, or a comment, I will be extracting those and sharing with our speakers today. So please know, if you're asking if I'm going to share this information that you've sent in the Q&A, I will take care of that as well, but you can certainly reach out to the presenters directly if you have other follow-on questions that you'd like to talk with them about. As was noted at the start of our session today, the URL shown in red is the seminar homepage for our session. And on that homepage, if you scroll up and down, there'll be a whole slew of resources and information related to our topic. So for those of you who are looking for copies of the presentation material, links to the calculator, links to the paper that was discussed in our session today, that content is already posted under the slides, references, and related link sections. So just scroll up and down. This is a sample snapshot. Note that there are plus and minus icons on the right side to collapse and expand sections. So feel free to go to the URL in red to locate the materials that were highlighted on today's session. And this URL is available from today forward. So you can bookmark it and pass it on to others as well. Many times I get asked if we offer CEUs or PDHs, and while I cannot offer those types of credit hours, I can provide you with a participation certificate if you fill out the feedback form. So on that very same homepage that I was just pointing you to, there is a section for our online feedback form. If you fill that feedback form out and include your email address and check the box at the bottom certifying you were here for the entire session, as soon as you submit your feedback, you will have access to a participation certificate like this one that you can download or print out for your own records. We will also email a copy, but those emails can get caught by junk or spam filters. So I usually encourage you to download it from the confirmation screen right after you send in your feedback. If you happen to share the line with multiple people or hosted a viewing party, simply give that URL to the homepage to everyone who joins you. They can fill out the feedback form on their own, even though they didn't register on their own, and still get a participation certificate based on their feedback. So again, if you're looking for those participation certificates, you have to fill out the feedback form, which is on the seminar homepage. And if you happen to be one of the lucky people replaying the recorded version of today's webinar, right about now in the archive above my head, there will be a button to that seminar feedback form that you can click and access it. For the live people, it's not there yet. You have to go to the website yourself. But for those of you who are watching the recorded version, we should have a button to the feedback form in the upper right. So you can still fill that form out, check the box that you replayed the entire session, and still get a certificate based off of your replay of the archive session for your own records. I should get the email confirming that the recording is available for on-demand playback out to each of you in about 1 week, and we encourage you to share it with other colleagues who will find this valuable information. So with that, I will thank all of our speakers and experts who joined us for today's session, along with the 170 people who joined us from all over the world for today's live broadcast. We hope that you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time and you will join us on a future internet seminar. With that, I'll go ahead and formally conclude today's live broadcast. We thank you all for joining us.